Welcome everyone to another episode of the ISAI Flyby Show.
Today's show is the first segment of Living in Space, Part 2. So last week, with Mark Hempsell and Stephen Ashworth, we discussed the incredible possibilities of billions of people living in vast colonies in space in the not-too-distant future. We talked about the technological requirements and the problems associated with that, and we also talked a little on the social and economic issues. So we know that such colonies are entirely possible in technical terms. I mean, some could even be in place in as little as 30 to 40 years. But are they humanly possible or desirable? And where are they going to lead? Those are the questions that we want to answer.
And who better to help us pick a way through these thorny questions than a person who is arguably Britain's greatest living science fiction writer? Stephen Baxter has written scores of SF novels in different science fiction genres, including authorised sequels to H.G. Wells' famous War of the Worlds, and he has also co-authored with legends such as Arthur C. Clarke and Terry Pratchett. He's won at least 18 awards for his writing, not to mention major nominations. If anyone can help us understand the implications of living in space, it's Stephen Baxter. So let's get started. Stephen Baxter, thanks very much for joining us today. Welcome. Given your incredible qualifications and background, especially with the list of novels that you've written, we're looking at a period which is quite short in your terms. You look into the far future. We've been looking in the last episode with the BIS team at the fairly near future, 100-150 years. But what we'd like to do in this program, if we could, is push those boundaries out a little bit further, maybe, you know, the next 500 years, and see what you think about that. But first things first, could we ask you to explain a little bit about how you get the ideas for your novels? I mean, how much science is there in the fiction?
Well, in my case, quite a lot, I guess I'd say, although not exclusively. I think I derive most of my ideas basically from the science, from following the science. And groups like the BIS, who are, it's engineering really there, yeah. Where they're looking at concepts of how you could get off the planet and move out and what the consequences might be. I got into science fiction in a way through science. And it was a recursive process. I'm old enough to remember the Apollo landings, which was just mind-blowing when I was, you know, mid-teens. Everyone remembers Armstrong and Aldrin and the first footsteps. But I loved the later missions when it was full colour. Mm. You know, the rover on the moon, they were there for days. And the description of the life in the lunar module was like it stopped being a vehicle for a while. It was a shack.
Yeah, that's right.
Shelter, you know, at their meals and washed up and so forth, and just fantastic. You know, so you actually had people literally living on another world only for a few days. But that really caught my imagination. You know, I thought that'd be like it's like a caravan, you know, a caravan walked on. So, but at the same time. I had an excellent school library where some philanthropist or saboteur possibly stocked the thing with old science fiction novels, meaning, you know, all the way from Wells to Clarke. And so I just binged on those at the same kind of age. And particularly Arthur C. Clarke, you know, I mean, there's no surprise that his name will come up because he had that mix of engineering nous, and he worked with the BIS in its early days. And he was picking up concepts from the engineering and transferring them to his fiction and vice versa as well. You know, fictional concept and you test it in engineering terms. So I did maths and engineering in my academic career. but I was always a bit restless. I went off to be a teacher, bust out of academia, didn't really fancy slogging through the, you know, endless research contracts. And I like contact with people as well. So I was a teacher for a while, and I paid no money at all. So, you know, I was in industry for a while again, but I was always drawn to sort of writing projects, you know, manuals and that sort of thing. And meanwhile, I was gradually building up my SF publication stream after sort of, you know, many years of struggling and trying to get it right.
Yeah.
Once I got a breakthrough, that kind of took over. And after a few years, I gave up the day job.
Yeah.
But I stayed with groups like the BIS, and there are other groups I'm involved with now on working on extraterrestrial ethics, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, kind of politic do you need in a confined environment where no one can escape? That sort of thing. So I do technical papers for those groups, including the BIS. With the BIS, you know, it's more rocketry and the mechanics of
wow.
Which is really interesting. And then and I can take that back. It's kind of feedback between my work and my sidelines, so to speak. Yes. It is a feedback process as well. I mean, in Galaxias, in my latest novel, they need to go out to the edge of the system quickly. And the clever way they do it is with a dark energy ram scoop. So a ram scoop is like a jet engine where you draw in material to power the spacecraft. Usually the concept is the interstellar medium, you know, the gases from the sun or between the stars. But in this concept, I've tried to work out how you would use dark energy to do that. And dark energy is this stuff that's everywhere, pushing the universe apart. What is it? We don't know. How do we access it? We don't know that either. But if you could, you see, you could go forever. So I came up with this wacky idea for the book, but then wrote it up as a paper in the end for BIS, a technical paper. Back came some really heavy criticism, you know, from the mostly it's impossible. But if, you know, it's an imaginative organization. If you just had this one thing, this one gadget to make it possible, then what could you do with it?
What a wonderful idea.
Well, it's a crossover between the edge of fiction on the one hand and the edge of plausibility on the other. So I think that's, happily for me, that's where I am. You know, I can still do plenty of academic stuff, which is peer reviewed and has to be done properly. But on the other hand, I'm making my living as my fiction and I have adventures like this.
tell me, talking about adventures, one of the things that fascinates me is that you wrote books with Arthur C. Clarke, and that is incredibly impressive. But what was he like to work with?
He was extremely enthusiastic, is the main thing.
Yeah.
This came about because he had long-term health problems.
Yeah.
Lived to a great age, but long-term health problems, and it gradually became more and more difficult for him to sustain a novel in terms of the writing of the thing. So, you know, you can have all the sort of secretaries and so forth you want, but it's the mental, lengthy concentration that he was having trouble with.
Yeah.
And so we looked for a collaborator, and we'd already worked together on a short story, which came about because of this kind of going back in reverse order, really. I was asked to interview him once by SFX magazine, so that was very good. I'd met him earlier, briefly, at a Clark Award event. Clark Award is for the best SF novel of the year. Yeah. So I was nominated, but I didn't win, but I got to meet Arthur in person briefly. So we had this kind of occasional chain of contact, and he liked my books. He gave some very kind blurbs to my early books, which is a lesson I've learned as well, you know, be generous to the up-and-comers. So he had this idea and gave it to his agent, and the agent contacted me because he knew about this previous personal contact, and off we went. So Arthur's outlines, I think they were probably all very cerebral. You know, you'd have some concept of a technology and how it might change the world, but no real characters. You know, I think he found his way through his characters in the writing of the story. So that was where I came in.
Interesting,
come up with characters who the best way to derive a story out of a situation like that is who's got a problem with it. In the first novel, it was the gadget was a time viewer, kind of the internet, but you could dial into the crucifixion of Christ or the Armada or something and just see it. However, want me to see what you were doing an hour ago, which is the downside. So we came up with a character who appear to have done something you hadn't done, faking this technology, and he has to get into the worms and into the guts of the technology to to find a personal solution, but that drives out the issues of the technology as well. So Arthur just loved it. He loved the drafts as we passed them backwards and forwards. I did the drafts mostly, but he'd scribble all over he'd type up comments all over the manuscripts. He's extremely enthusiastic. He's in Sri Lanka, and I'm in Britain. That's right. And so several hours apart. And in his later years, he was, I think he was a bit adrift from the human world because of a lot of hospital appointments and so forth.
Yeah.
So I'd be up at 3 a.m. or 10 in the morning or the afternoon. If he needed to phone me up, he'd just phone me up. Yeah. Sometimes 3 a.m. Oh, wow. I got the call, and sometimes we just went through, We'd always say, oh, well, this is Arthur. I'll speak to you in a few hours. Arthur, over and out. So just hugely enthusiastic. And but he was a bit of a name dropper. I'll give you that. One point, we were throwing in playful stuff, stuff that will be revealed about, present-day politicians in the future.
Yeah.
At one point, we had Bill Gates thrown in prison, or I did, stealing somebody else's idea. And Robert says, you can't do that. I know Bill Gates. He's a friend of mine. We had to delete Bill.
Oh, on the other hand,
as we were working on it, we came across a bit of speculation about Abraham Lincoln, the president, he might have been gay. And this comes from a period in his life. He was a young lawyer, and he shared a bed with another man. Well, apparently that wasn't unusual.
That was common,
The 1850s, it was just normal.
Yeah.
So we were playing around with this. And in the end, we came up with a scenario where in the future, Lincoln is outed as gay, right? Everyone accepts he's gay, and then the Time Viewer proves he isn't. Arthur said, oh, that's splendid. That will annoy everybody. His driving force is enthusiasm. I once asked him how he felt about 2001 and the way the space program diverged from what they imagined in 1968. Carrying on with Apollo onto Mars and all that manned programs, programs, versus the shutdown really of the manned program and all the energy going into unmanned probes. He said he loved it all. He loved it all. He said in fact when he was writing his first novels about the British space program in about 1940 or so, he didn't really believe it would all happen in his lifetime as he was depicting in his books. I think he thought it would be 50 or 100 years further out. So he was delighted to see, the Voyagers and the Galileo spacecraft and all that going to the moons of Jupiter. And some of that was reflected in his own fiction, missions to the moons of Jupiter in 2061, I think, or was it 2010, one of them. So he didn't fret about lost opportunities. He grabbed onto what he could have.
Yeah,
he was one of the first people I knew on the internet. He was one of the first people I knew to have a really good professional astronomical telescope in his back garden so he could look at satellites and so on. He had the money and the contacts, so there you go. He was living the boy's dream, really.
I think he probably deserved it, though, given what he's contributed.
Yeah. So but enthusiasm, I think that's the one lesson I've learned as I'm getting older myself, try to keep the enthusiasm going.
Yeah.
Or at least drive it from other people.
Yes, bringing it back, of course, to the practical side of living in space and colonies. We had Mark Hempsel and Stephen Ashworth on the last episode, and they made a great case for the engineering being pretty much within our own capabilities in the next however many decades. But what, in your opinion, do you think would be new technologies that are going to be needed before these colonies even become reality, really?
Well, I think they're right that it's conceivable. Within our current grasp, in a sense. I worked on a big project with the BIS, which those gentlemen helped advise on as well, called Avalon. It's the latest generation of these designs of colonies, really. The first realistic proposals came out in the 50s. Werner von Braun, he was going to have a sort of military wheel in space. It was going to be like a battleship. It would fend off nuclear fighters coming up from the Soviet Union.
Oh my lord!
Buck Rogers.
Yeah, happily we didn't go down that far. But more like Dr. Strangelove. Actually, it was more like Cold War.
Yeah.
Then in the '70s, there was a guy called Gerard K. O'Neill, who working in Stanford, came up with expansion of these designs, but with much more plausible life support, recycling the air and the water and so forth. So you could get away without much resupply. And those, the 70s designs are what have been taken forward now, I think, into our design. But it's all much harder than you think it is at first, I think, in space is one lesson, you know. So our design, we spent far longer on the air conditioning than anything else, you know. You've got 10,000 people. You need air conditioners for 10,000 people. Yeah. You can't afford a major leak.
Of course. You've
got to grow your own food, and that's another whole huge recycling job. So there's masses and masses of energy flowing in there, even if you have sunlight energy, just to keep the basic housekeeping going. And I think what we're learning is how much the earth does for us. You know, each of us in the West uses something like 100 kilowatts of power for this kind of stuff, you know, and our daily lives, which sounds a lot, but there's far more energy beating down from the space in the form of solar energy, keeping the grass growing, keeping the food going, keeping the air circulating for us. All this is done for free, we imagine it, on the Earth. But you've got to do it all in space. So I think we're actually learning a hell of a lot about the biosphere itself.
Of course.
Experiments a couple of decades ago was Biosphere 2, which you may have heard. It was a big domed enclosure on the ground in Arizona, half a dozen people in this football field-sized dome with, they had a sort of oceanic bit and a desert bit, and they had to grow their own food, huge air conditioning systems, as I've described, and they just got on with it and saw how it went. In the end, they did pretty well. There was a 10% leakage, you know, of breakdown of the life support, which isn't bad for your first try. But what they found was that everything was much more difficult than they thought. They all spent the whole time cleaning moss off the equipment and that kind of thing. You know, the moss would lie off in the fresh air. Rather than doing science and writing poetry and playing guitars and so on, it was all a bit hippie. No, you were kind of like low-level farm labourers just to keep it going. So I think I would like to see more experiments like that on the ground, because everything except zero gravity is there. And I think there's going to be a big effort necessary to put that basic knowledge in. When you look back at the older designs, they're really quite naive, you know.
Yes.
But we're getting there towards a system that is more sustainable. I'm interested in going beyond Steve Ashworth and Mark, though, in terms of colony ships. You don't get anywhere near the speed of light. You're going to take 1% of the speed of light, 400 years to Alpha Centauri, say, whole generations living in an enclosed environment with no hope of resupply and so forth. So that's the next level up, you know, from the leaky old tubs like the ISS that we have now. Then you get reasonably good enclosed colonies that we could use to inhabit the solar system, stick an engine on it then, and off you go. I think once we've perfected those systems, then yes, the solar system will be our oyster. In a bed of oysters.
That's interesting, isn't it? So you're saying that you could see a future where some of these colonies could be powered, given engines, and sent off spinning into space to colonize other star systems.
Well, yes. In another forum, I mentioned the political forums I'm involved in. I did a paper on this, on political forums and Generation Starship, and the ethics, in fact. Because it's a bit like a prison in a way, or a colony island maybe, where you're dumping people forever, and they have children who are going to grow up and die on the ship before it arrives at its destination. It's quite a difficult ethical dilemma, that, and I'm not really sure of the validity of the arguments in some ways. Is it really right to do this to people? But I think technologically, once we perfect life support systems off the Earth, that's the most difficult part, I think, then sticking a rocket engine on the end of it and sending it away is quite feasible. So, but I think I see those things as it's not a giant leap for an Earthbound culture like ours. It will be in the Ashworth-Hemsel future, when we have much more colonies out around Jupiter, when the challenge is almost as hard, you know, it's years away from the Earth, although not centuries. You're going to have very, very secure systems and so forth. And presumably as well, mature political systems and so forth. So that's legal systems, so that people's rights respected in their situations.
Yeah, we wanted to come down to that. One of the things that's always fascinated me about colony ships, because they've been obviously talked about in science fiction many times, but if you've got a 400-year voyage in a colony ship and maybe a million people within the ship, what happens at the end of that? Would there be the equivalent of agoraphobia for the colonists when they reach their destination and actually don't want to get off?
I think that could well be true, especially if they were descended from maybe centuries of solar system colonies, yep. You know, housing the Oort cloud and so on.
Yep.
So it may be more than agoraphobia, it may be an adaptation. You know, we may be conservative about keeping the human form, but you can imagine the human of the future who doesn't need strong legs, for instance. Legs might be more like flippers or balancing objects. Strong upper arms and maybe better lung capacity, other kind of adaptations to zero gravity. Mm. They would be just as uncomfortable on the ground as we would be in zero gravity for a decade, say.
Well, that's the same with those astronauts coming back from the ISS, struggling with things like osteoporosis coming back.
Yes.
They just don't have the muscle mass that they can't build up in those particular areas. Do you reckon that's going to be an issue as well? They'll get to a planet and just fall over.
Well, it could well be, yes. Yeah, you'd like to think they'd plan ahead for that.
You'd hope so.
the generations are going to go down there. But yes. Yeah, I looked at a New Scientist session the other day. I shouldn't just say I can't remember the author's name, but it was about those issues, present-day issues of sending one twin into space for a year, looking at the other twin on the ground. They found genetic differences even, genetic drift.
Mm. That's right.
Genetic damage, rather, to organisms in space.
That was the two NASA guys, or one NASA guy went up there and the twins stayed on Earth.
Yes, and they put them through the same battery of tests just to see the difference zero gravity makes. It makes quite a big difference, even down to the genetic level. I think, though, that we will get over these kind of problems in terms of adaptation to space in the coming centuries, in the solar system. But as you say, it might be just a much of a shock to space colonists to have to be dumped down on the planet out of Centauri, as it would for us to be taken up into space in the first place.
Yeah, it's sort of a psychological thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But then maybe one model that people often quote is the Polynesians, who, you know, their wonderful sailing technologies enabled them to get as far as Hawaii, didn't they?
Obviously,
halfway across the Pacific. Fantastic, really. Very primitive, well, sophisticated, but with primitive materials.
Yes.
But it seems in some of the islands, they would arrive, set up a colony, a few generations would go by, and then off they would go again, almost like recovering the boat technology in a way, or preserving it to go fishing, the stuff.
Yeah.
But the really sophisticated transoceanic stuff must have had to be redeveloped or rediscovered somehow.
So the navigation.
Yeah, or even, you know, the seaworthiness of the boats.
Yeah,
I imagine. So maybe there'll be a pattern like that of oscillating cultures, land-borne cultures, or, you know, static cultures in space versus transient cultures,
and trade-offs. And some would live, and some would die out. It's really absolutely fascinating. Do you think, as an engineer and a mathematician, that we'll ever get to the stage where we have anti-gravity drives?
Oh, it's for the benefit of future generations, I say yes. because who can say what's around the corner in terms of physics and cosmology and so on? One thing I've enjoyed about growing older is seeing revolutions in science of all sorts. You know, it's terrific. I've recently been looking into H.G. Wells's cosmology and what he understood at the time of writing books like The War of the Worlds, you know.
Yes.
You think of Wells and the kind of Percival Lowell Mars from which invaded Cain, canals, you know, beings roughly like us and so forth. However, also in that book, you've got the heat ray. It's a big weapon. And the heat ray appears to be based on the thermodynamics of the time. They understand heat in terms of the laws that we use now. And the heat ray seems to work off a box of hot stuff as hot as the sun, and you just open a window and out comes the heat and the radiation. So it's slightly naive. Actually, it was banged up to date. A few years later, Planck came along with a much better understanding of radiation. So it wouldn't be an invisible ray, it'd be a very bright ray. A few years after that, you get Einstein and the fusion processes of the sun being understood. So you could see where the heat is actually coming from. So Wells did his best. You know, he didn't know whether heat was created by it. No one knew what was keeping the sun hot. But he grabs a piece and uses it as a weapon. And then, you know, 50 years later, he could use it. It'd be a fusion blaster based on science he couldn't really have predicted at the time. So that's a sort of 50-year jump retrospectively with whole new vistas of energy and forms of matter and so on, which nobody really imagined before. But it was built on, you know, the foundations laid back in the Victorian age.
So the fascinating thing is whether science leads science fiction or science fiction leads science.
Well, I think it's a bit of both, really. I mean, Wells pushed the boat out as far as he could in many ways. But he got the orbits right of his cylinders moving between the planets.
Yeah.
He knew about that. He knew about conjunctions and oppositions of the planets. So he used what was in the science to derive his science fiction. But then, you know, you push forward to visions of alien life and so forth, which he pioneered. So there is his Martians are still a model of the one model, you know, of what we might find on other worlds. So there's a healthy interplay, I think, which is a good thing. I think some aspects of science are more like science fiction than others, though, like the Fermi paradox.
Yes,
that came from the scientists feeding off science fiction images in a way. Flying saucer scares, which came from the movies, and H.G. Wells to some extent, you know, the invasion of hoax of 1930. Yeah.
Oh, of course.
So irrational fears of flying saucers. Fermi was a great physicist who is in discussion one day, having lunch with, among others, Edward Teller, who was like the real life Dr. Strangelove, the H-bomb guy.
Yeah.
Having lunch, and they're talking about a flying saucer scare in New York, which apparently was to do with taking away garbage pails. Oh, it's got to be the aliens, you know. And Fermi suddenly said, look, they ought to be here, actually. We should be seeing them. And his argument was, well, we're on this planet. Unless we're completely unique, which is very strange, there must be other life forms out there. Some of them should be more advanced than we are. It doesn't take that long to colonize a galaxy. In terms of millions of years, we've been around millions of years. So they should be here. We should actually be here. We should be seeing flying saucers, Fermi said. And that's the Fermi paradox. There's something wrong, you know, that we should be seeing evidence of expansive cultures like ours out there somewhere, even if it's just, you know, Dyson spheres enclosing the suns, capturing stars' light. And yet we don't. There's something wrong with our models there somehow, which generates in turn masses of science fiction ideas. And my latest novel, Galaxias, it fits into that realm. We don't see them in this case because there's one all-controlling authority, if you like, keeping everything down. The place is like a game reserve being contained by keepers that we can't see, which is a solution to the Fermi paradox. You know, that is known as the zoo paradox, the zoo hypothesis.
Yes.
I think Fermi is a real football field of the ball being passed between the scientists and the philosophers and the ethnologists and all that, and the science fiction writers. So I think it's all very fertile, really.
All very fertile. Those are powerful words about an engrossing subject. And Stephen Baxter continues his thoughts next week in the second part of his interview. The Fermi paradox asks why, if aliens absolutely must be out there somewhere, we haven't seen them yet. The problem, of course, is that all paradoxes are only such because we view them in terms of our current levels of science and knowledge. What if Fermi was missing a major aspect of the conundrum? Perhaps that alien life forms would be far, far in advance of our own levels of development. Any alien species that was at our own level would not be able to reach us. For instance, we're having severe problems getting to one of the nearest planets, Mars, never mind trying to visit far-off star systems or even other galaxies. The issue, therefore, comes down to the possibility of very advanced civilizations, thousands of years or even millions of years ahead of us, as envisaged in Stephen Baxter's new book, Galaxias. The real question might therefore be, if alien life is so far in advance of us, would they allow themselves to be seen? If we think in those terms, of aliens being millions of years ahead of us and possibly not even taking purely biological forms, the Fermi paradox simply disappears. Don't miss the next instalment, because Stephen talks about some of the most pressing problems about living in space. Should we be thinking of terraforming planets like Mars and Venus? How sustainable is it to continue with our present generations of chemical rockets? How ethical would it be to send millions of people into space in search of new worlds? Something to think about in the days before the next part of Stephen Baxter's great appearance on the iSci Flyby show. See you then.